nun?
Shall we start?
So then, I hope you enjoyed your lunchtime. Our next talk for today is Michael Ibe. He's one of those writers who submitted a paper which we in the end did not let go into the proceedings. But as we thought the topic is still very interesting, we rather make this not a demo, but a presentation of the ideas. And I think we don't have any slides on the web about this project, but then it's even the more important to be here and understand what he has to say. I hope you enjoy it.
Thank you. Sounded like it's a term used by the film and commercial music industry for pieces which sound like famous pieces, but without violating copyright issues, just to say this first. I think it's quite important to say something about the biographical backgrounds of Christian von Borries and myself, because we are both coming from the classical music, which is quite unusual, I think, in this context. And we are both interpreters, we are not composers, I have to say. And so Christian was a solo flutist at the Zurich Opera, and before he started conducting, finally. And I made myself at least part of my living by being a concert pianist up to 1 year ago. And we were both independently struggling with the classical music scene for a very long time. For example, when I lived in London, there were probably the richest scene in classical music of the world. And you had many, many classical concerts a day, even with orchestras and all together, everything. But still, you could say that the group of piano concertos, which made 95% of the concertos, were just five or six different pieces. So that made me think about that people always want to hear the same, which I find a very strange thing. So I started working with this, and placing music in different contexts and kind of giving people a little bit of strange feeling so that they get out of the concert a little bit distorted or confused. So the first project I was doing with Christian was Psychogeography 4, or Psychogeography 4. Psychogeography is a term used by the situationists in the 50s and 60s. The most famous philosopher of that group is Guy Debord, which was, or at least one of the various kinds of this psychogeography, was investigating urban space for its history and its qualities. And in this series of concerts, Psychogeography, it was about contamination of a musical contamination of spaces like concert rooms, like the Bayreuth Festival House, and the music itself. Like if you're listening to, let's say, the Chopin Funeral March, you always immediately think of state funerals. It has nothing to do with the second piano sonata anymore. So this piece changed very much in our conscious. And there are, let's say, social developments, like, for example, the music of Wagner, which is still very unpopular in Israel for obvious reasons because of the connections to the Nazi regime in Germany. And they are very private experiences, like you go to a concert and certain things are happening, which very much influence your impression of the piece. So in this psychogeography, the contaminated place actually was the head, the brain itself. And we were using quotes by Robert Schumann, the romantic componist, composer, who was saying that, I mean, in his very schizophrenic state, very late in his life, that all music appeared to him much too fast. He wanted everything to have to become slower. So. His preferences changed very much to what we are used to hear. And we're using these kind of quotes and certain other aspects to, and the music of Robert Schumann actually, which we made in a full score out of his work, I mean, with many little parts, like score sampling, you could call it, But on top of that, I used a modified version of the Facelock for Coda by Miller Paquette, which actually was able to made the orchestra sound stand still. So it just would stop and you just had the sound, but the orchestra wouldn't play anymore, but it was just electronics. And you really couldn't tell that actually it switched from live music to electronics. And we're using these kind of things, the material which was recorded during the concert, I mean, to do all kinds of electronic things. So in the end of the concert, you mostly had electronic sounds without the audience maybe realizing too much, or perhaps by that time they had realized. And then we had the idea, and I was using a very cheap shareware for that, of analyzing a very kitsch-like string orchestra version of the Schumann Träumerei, to reorchestrate it with all the overtones and all the qualities it has for orchestra, and not using any electronics with that, which sounded like the first sample I wanted to play to you. So although this sounded very much like there was electronic involved, it was just instrumental music. The second important aspect, and I mean, all the orchestration was done manually now, and I mean, for further developments, it was clear, I mean, I couldn't do this. I mean, it took me, I think, 3 or 4 days just to set the notes for this kind of thing, that we had to develop some automatism to that. Another aspect which is very much discussed at the moment are the cultural and intellectual properties and common things. And actually there's, and all I can say is for the German legal issues, there's a very interesting a sentence by the German Constitutional Court in the case of Bertolt Brecht, the people who now own the rights for Bertolt Brecht, versus Heiner Müller, who is a quite famous author in Germany, who used pages of original Brecht in one of his plays and later in the book. And the Constitutional Court decided or said that as soon as a piece of art enters the cultural context, in a way, somebody has to be able to refer to it. So what we had, the problem, I mean, there are letters by Stockhausen, for example, concerning our work, that he's saying, you are not allowed to do this because it's my piece and I don't allow, I mean, independently of all kind of financial things, he is claiming that he can forbid us to use his things for putting them into another context. If that would happen for journalism, I mean, we wouldn't have any news nowadays. So what the Constitutional Court was saying basically is that similar rules for arts must apply to journalism. And that was another very important aspect for us. I mean, you cannot really say this is Schumann, and we have much more abstract examples of music, how it sounded after running through the sound-alike program, that really wouldn't recognize it anymore, but we are still claiming we are doing this because it's a kind of a comment to this work. So this is an open question I cannot answer, really. And the fourth point here is now that for me it was very important to program the whole thing in an open source context, because if everything has to be should be open, like, I mean, you have access to common cultural property, you should have a software, or you should develop a software which is open as well. But I think I don't have to explain this to you anyway. So next one, please. So I finally found the following combination of softwares. I'm used to work with Pure Data. I have been using it for many, many years, so it's quite the most familiar software I'm using. And especially, okay, now I can. Then I discovered this ATSA or ATS software, which was originally by Stanford University. It's not the newest algorithms in sound analysis, but they are if you find the right parameters, it's working astonishingly well. And now there's a version in C, because actually before it was, I think, for common music or something like that, which works much more effective, of course. And I found out that, I mean, if you find the right parameters, it's no problem to resynthesize with a sinus oscillator bank language that it's understandable. I was very impressed by this. It generates files, actually, which are up to 1,000 times bigger or larger than the original audio file. So 1 megabyte of audio file would make 1 gigabyte of analysis file. Of course, there's this wonderful LilyPond program, which is very suitable for such a purpose because it's scriptable. And there are the two externals very important for Pure Data for this project, which is the PX external by Thomas Grill and the ATS read external, which reads the ATS file format by Alex Norman. And I mean, mainly I used the Python and Eric environment doing the programming inside Pure Data, which looks in the end like the next slide, like this. So you could do all the things from one surface, basically. So we can just proceed to the next one. The program reads a wave file, a monophonic wave file. It runs through the ATS analysis with the given parameters and outputs an ATS file, which again is read into my Python script file to generate as well the score as the parts of the LilyPond file format, and for control reasons, files for an oscillator bank. I mean, just that you could see what you're doing and how to adjust the parameters. The LilyPond information then is just compiled and being output as PDF files and as MIDI files, again for control reasons, that you could just see how that should sound, which appeared to be a very important thing, actually. So I'm showing you one of the latest examples I was doing with a quite famous piece. Maybe we could just...
The last one?
No, second oh, wave. minus a simulation of the same thing after it was run through ATS. As you can see, there are quite some changes between the various stages of the states of the piece. It's maybe comparable as to appropriation art things. I mean, like people in the 80s used to use photographs and cross the pixels to very big things, so that just the appearance of the picture would change completely, but and gives it a new meaning. What you actually can define in these, I mean, you already heard in the sinus simulation that there was a certain kind of, you could hear already the measures Lilliput was doing, because very often, I mean, just the da-da-di-da-di wouldn't just fit into the singer, so it would drop one note, or it would come too early or come too late. That's because, I mean, we had to decide the main subject or the main problem of the whole thing is to make it playable for an orchestra. And so we decided basically that the smallest value for the musicians to be played should be 16th note at a tempo of 120 per quarter or per fourth beat. And so you have this kind of quantization in the music already in the sinus simulation. And in the MIDI simulation, you had then another point, I mean, that we had to decide how many dynamic ranges or how to map the dynamic ranges. So you would hear these bass notes, although they are, I think, four times piano, I mean, four P's, they are still quite audible in this context. So the whole appearance, the image of the music changes a lot just by doing this, but I find this actually a very interesting aspect of the whole project. We are not targeting like IRCAM or Fraunhofer Institute of finding a solution. I mean, I wouldn't be capable of wrong with this. Finding a human solution for a human musical solution, like you play a piece and you get a score which looks like the score actually the musicians played for doing the recording. I find it very interesting, I mean, to have a conductor conducting a complete different tempo than the music is sounding, because the conductor is always conducting 125, but the music might be much slower or much faster, and then you get a shift in what you're listening to and what you're seeing, and this kind of foreign feeling. So you could, you can define your orchestra just as you want. in three types. I mean, like string instruments, which can play or preferably play softer passages. I didn't use it since the MIDI simulation right now because I only use the strings. And the woodwind, which would play a little bit louder things, and the brass, which play the loudest notes. Then the whole thing is registered. That means that every group of instruments would only be able or to play a certain range of the full spectrum. Like, I mean, the first violins who are playing, some of them very solistic notated, the overtones of the piece would have a range of one octave to play, whereas the tuba player, who is known not to be the most advanced or most ambitious player in general, would only have three different notes to play as a range. You can define these registration yourself in by defining the orchestra. The same applies to transposition and the clef you want to use, and you can do this separately for score and for the parts. So I think we can drop the next one because I already said this basically. Some things of this I said already too. So for the orchestration, you can decide on the trigger time, which basically defines the speed of the score, and which notes or which sounds are taken into account, or and which time the ATS file is triggered. But since many important or loud sounds could be lost, I mean, there's a window you can define, which size you can define as well, so that you can include these maximum amplitudes. And there's an offset you can play with, I mean, just to, if you're completely offbeat and there's certain things, and very important things are missing, that you can just adjust this as well. And then mainly the program refers to amplitude things, I mean, like sounds under a certain level just wouldn't be taken account. And again, here's a kind of a window, so that, I mean, if the loudest note, let's say, would be minus 20 dB, I mean, you would just take account, I mean, the others taking into account would just be up to minus 25 dB or something like that. Then you can define the threshold from which point on the woodwind or the brass instruments would be suitable for orchestration. And again, you can define the range of the dynamics you want to use. And then again, I mean, there's the option to use 32nd notes, which may be suitable in certain cases. But then I want to show you one of the scores coming out of this whole thing. This is the spoken word sound-alike, actually, as a one-page full score. I think it's not the best resolution, but you may be able to see some things. And again, I mean, we did this project or one performance of this thing a couple of weeks ago. And again, it showed that playability is the hardest issue to solve in the whole thing, because we only had one day of orchestra rehearsals for 1.5 hours of music. And it showed that it was just not enough time, I mean, to make an orchestra realize the play. I mean, the point is, contrary to all other music, or most other music I know, this only works if people are really playing in time. So if just some people wouldn't play, or would play too late or too early, it just doesn't work at all. And there's nothing like a bad performance of Mozart, where you just say, okay, they were not together, but I mean, still you recognize the music. And I want to play to you now the word sound alike, first as the MIDI simulation of this score, and then as the orchestra, the live orchestra version, and you will see, I mean, that we have to do lots of more work to make it more playable in the future. Okay, you can play it again, maybe, so people can realize. So I wouldn't recognize a thing. So okay, I think that's about it. I mean, we're still working on it, as you can see, to get it better. But that's about the idea. Do you have any questions?
Other questions? Yes.
Hello, Daniel James, England. I was just curious about the copyright implications. You mentioned a legal case which related to this area, but I remember when samplers were first introduced, there was a sort of a backlash from the musicians who were having their work sampled, and I wonder if we were talking about music that's still in copyright, and you apply this mechanical transformation, which is obviously different to the transformation a musician would normally do when they hear a piece of music and they change it in their mind and play it out differently. Because there's a computer element involved, do you think if this software became known amongst copyright holders, they would be up in arms about it?
I mean, we have heavily discussions with the GEMA, the German copyright organization. And I mean, the whole question about copyright itself is very, very difficult. I mean, the main difficulty I see, I mean, even internationally, not only for Germany, is that there are no really cases closed. So most cases are being solved before it really comes to an official judgment. Just because of the money involved. So if some major recording companies threatens with $200,000, I mean, there's just nothing to happen from a small artist to fight against. And even the Plunderphonics by John Oswald, I mean, he just redraw the things he put on his website because of those threats. I'm quite sure that it would, or that it violates nowadays copyright restrictions, I mean, as they are understood nowadays. And but the other question is, I mean, we are ready to pay money, let's say, to Stockhausen or whoever we use. There's no way of finding a very fair way of paying it. I mean, because I mean, they are coming and say, "Okay, you're using my piece. I get all of your income," and that's not just the way it's going to work, because it's just a very small aspect of the piece, and there's no, let's say, fair distribution of what other people contributed to this piece. And I think this is the hardest work to do in the near future. I'm not saying, I mean, I'm not I'm claiming that copyright has to be violated and that you should just use everything you want. I think there has to be found some solution, but at the moment it doesn't seem so like there will be any kind of reasonable solution in the near future.
Any other questions? I was wondering myself, while you're sitting there, is there some web page documenting how you did all this so for people to read up after the conference? Is there some remarkable?
I wrote a German text actually about the whole thing for a German magazine. There's nothing in English yet. That's the main problem.
It's a to-do item.
I will do some someday, but at the moment it's a bit difficult. Time-wise.
Okay, then if that's all, then thank you very much.
Okay,
Michael.
Thank you.
And then we'll continue by 3 p.m. with Daniel James on the 64 studio.